Hello and welcome to the first ever William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast. Over the coming weeks, we will be talking about the six shortlisted books for this year's award, as well as revisiting some classic sports books alongside guests from the literary world. This will all lead to the announcement of the winner on December the 5th at a ceremony in London, and later on in the show, we'll be letting you know how you can join us there. The Sports Book of the Year has often been cited as a catalyst for the improvement of sports writing. This year's chair of the judging panel, author and sports writer at the Times, Alison Rudd, has described the award as an institution that has changed the landscape of sports writing and helped enormously to improve its quality. Joining Alison on the judging panel are retired professional footballer and former chair of the PFA, Clark Carlisle, five-time Olympic medalist and rower, Dame Catherine Granger, broadcaster and writer John Inverdale, broadcaster Danny Kelly, and journalist and broadcaster Mark Lawson. And joining me, Joe Crilly, here in the studio is Ollie Blackwell. We're here for the first time, Ollie. How are you feeling?
I'm well, thanks. Yeah, slightly daunted to be introducing that vaulted list of people you just reeled off there. But no, raring to go, I think.
So what are we doing here today? Later on, we'll be speaking to the chair of the judging panel, Alison Rudd, who spoke to Ollie earlier about one of her favourite sports books. Before that, however, we'll be speaking to our first shortlisted author, Adarin and Finn. We're getting ahead of ourselves, though. Alongside his five fellow shortlisted authors, Ollie, would you be able to explain how Adarin and made it through to this stage of proceedings?
Yeah, so there were 151 submissions for this year's award, which we've consulted the dusty sportsbook archives, and we've seen that that's a record. There's entries not just from authors here in the UK. We've had books from across Australia, the US, and the range of writing in the sports covered is massive as well. So from basketball, I think we had a couple of entries on that. And then also pigeon racing, which was our first entry for pigeon racing, which made the long list. So Homings by John Day made the long list. So it's a 14 strong long list from that 151. That 14 is now whittled down into six. I think we'll introduce each of the books in full as we go along in each of the podcasts. But just to give you a little flavour, we've got Duncan Hamilton and Don McRae, the two stalwarts of the award, who've both won twice, so vying for a third crown this year for their respective works. Andy Woodward's work, Position of Trust, and he was the first whistleblower on the sex abuse scandal that has kind of rocked football. First entry for Lara Priyapama for her account of winning the Mongol Derby at the age of just 19. It's a 1,000-kilometre horse race.
What were you doing when you were 19, Ollie?
I was certainly not in Mongolia tracing the plains as she does. But yes, and if you thought we could keep Donald Trump off the Sports Book of the Year, you thought wrong. He has even made his way onto the shortlist for Rick Riley's Commander in Cheat, which lists the litany of cheating and maneuvering that Trump employs to maintain this image that he is, of course, brilliant at golf. So, as I said, real range there. And completing the shortlist is Adarin and Finn, which I guess brings us nicely on to our first guest who's going to be joining us. So, Joe, you spoke to Adarin and earlier. What did you speak about?
Yeah, so I've actually read the book a couple of times now. So just a quick kind of précis to the interview before we go into it. Adarin and Finn is shortlisted for the second time for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year for his book Rise of the Ultra Runners, A Journey to the Edge of Human Endurance. His book is a chronicle of his own attempt to earn the requisite qualifying points to take part in the ultimate ultramarathon, the Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc. As we follow his journey, Adarin and introduces us to the world of ultra running. We're introduced to the characters, the races, the physical and mental fatigue, the obsession, and the euphoric highs that go with being an ultra runner. And we spoke about all that and more when I sat down with Adarin and earlier.
You're listening to the William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast.
Adarin and, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on making the Sports Book of the Year shortlist for a second time.
Oh, it's great to be here. Great to be on the shortlist again.
As well as Rise of the Ultra Runner, you've released two other books about running, Way of the Runner and Running with the Kenyans. And early on in the latest book, you compete in a race in Scotland with your brother. Yeah. I take it running has been a staple of the Finn family for quite some time. So, I mean, how did that sport enter your life and where did it begin to take a hold on you?
I mean, I'm the eldest, so I kind of set the pattern. My primary school, there was no kind of competitive sport. And I joined the secondary school and almost the first week they sent us out on this cross-country run, the whole school. And I had no idea what we just knew we had to follow the leader. And I was the leader, and then I won the race. And it was like, wow, I'm good at something. I like this. And it kind of grew from there. My brothers just followed me, basically. And they both happened to be decent runners. But luckily for me, our family rivalry is always kind of centered around the thing that I've been good at, which is good because they're a lot better than me at lots of other things. So we over the years, we've done a lot of running together. And I got quite seriously into it, more than they did. When I was younger, I ran, you know, county cross country, county track, and been running ever since.
Onto the book. The main narrative of Rise of the Ultra Runners is your attempt to earn the qualifying points to compete in the UTMB, which is the Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc. Your journey starts in Oman, where you metaphorically stumble into the Oman Desert Marathon, and then literally stumble across the finishing line. At that point, very early on in the book, you say, I'm never going to do anything as stupid as that ever again. Yeah.
I remember when I wrote that, I thought, well, obviously I am, because it's the start of a book called The Rise of the Ultra Runners, but that was sort of the joke. But that is how you feel after you finish every one of those races, but particularly that one, because at that point I had no plans to do anymore. And I was just like, this is such a stupid idea, such a stupid sport, such a, you know, harebrained idea. I don't need to do this again.
So, I mean, there is kind of like a switch that is flicked halfway through the first chapter after the prologue, where you go, actually, I'm going to give this a go. What did that feel like? It kind of like in a mental and physical, once you'd got over the draining nature of the marathon?
I mean, I guess that first chapter happens kind of quite a few months after the Oman race, I think, and I'm getting it again now because I haven't done an ultra run for a year, and yet I've been in this space where I don't want to do that again. And then it's this kind of slowly growing feeling of like, you know what, I kind of miss that adventure that I had out there, that real kind of sense of digging deep into myself and kind of getting way away from the rest of the world, way away from my job, my life, and just kind of being out in the wilderness. And that starts to grow on you. It's not a sudden, it's not like one day you don't want to do it and the next day you do, or not for me anyway. It was a kind of growing feeling. And, you know, that combined with the fact that this was such a growing sport, had so many more people doing it, it was one of the fastest growing sports in the world. It really kind of made me think something I could explore here, definitely.
Well, that's something that the title touches on, the rise of the ultra runners. The rise itself is the fact that the sport is one of the biggest growing sports in the world at the time. We know the benefit of exercise in promoting positive mental health, which we might go into a little bit later, because there are definite highs and definite lows within the book. But does it say anything about the collective mental health of society that this sport is becoming so popular?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure it's an indictment of the state of the mental health, but I think it's more related to the lifestyles we lead, quite sedated, that we're quite comfortable. And so there's something in us, I describe it, there's some kind of need to be a bit wild, a need to kind of connect with our primitive selves. And I think that need is not fulfilled in most people's lives. Most people work in air-conditioned offices, they drive to work, or they get air-conditioned buses, and even a short bike ride of 5 minutes, 10 minutes is not going to really, you know, open you out to the elements in the way that we're walking around in modern society, but we're living in kind of prehistoric bodies still that kind of have these needs to be wild and to be out there and to be experiencing the extremes of life. And so I think the fact that we're so removed from that, it means that the antidote of that is not only ultra running. I mean, things like wild swimming are growing very, very rapidly. All these sports that are quite extreme and quite involved in getting out into the wild are growing.
And you kind of go through, it seems like every race that you take part in, you go through this kind of existential crisis somewhere between halfway and three quarters of the way
to the race. There is a pattern that starts to emerge, doesn't
it? So, I mean, what is going on with your body and with your mind when you get to that particular point in the race where you can either say, right, I'm giving up, or I'm going to go? There was it Lowry Morgan when you were running through Anglesey and you saw her, and she eventually pulled up because she's just like, well, I'm with my family. Yeah. I've got my kid here. I'm not
feeling very well. And she had done that race before. So she had fewer reasons to finish than I had. So one thing you need is a really strong idea or understanding of why you're doing the race. Because if you just entered it on a whim, there comes a point where you're in every race where you're struggling so much and your body is doing it for a reason. It's protecting you. So it realizes you're kind of going under insane stresses and strains. And it kind of knows you don't really need to be. So it says, look, just stop, you know. And that makes sense to you at that point in time, because it does make sense. You probably should stop for your well-being, and there's no harm in stopping. It's not a life and death situation. So you have to be very clear in your motivation why you're carrying on, because that has to really shine through all those doubts. And so I found the races where, for example, I had this long-term plan to run the UTMB, the races where I needed to finish to get the points were much easier for me to finish than the other races. And even the fact that I was writing a book about it was quite interesting, because that played into the dynamic, because I kept having this argument that it would be quite good to drop out of one race to tell that story. And so every race I kept thinking, no, this is the race I drop out. And so you don't even have to finish for the book. It doesn't matter. And then that was playing on my mind, and without ruining it, I generally get over that, and I have this. And so what happens is your body, what I learned, I did a lot of digging around into this, and there's a brilliant book on this called Endure by Alex Hutchinson. And it talks about the fact that the mind basically wants to protect you. So it starts shutting you down before you actually need to be shut down, when you've still actually got reserves of energy, plenty of energy in reserve. But the mind senses danger, and it wants to protect you for two reasons. One, it doesn't want you to hurt yourself. And two, it wants to save some energy in case of an emergency, in case, you know, like I said, we're in prehistoric bodies. So in case a lion or a saber-toothed tiger jumps out on us, you can suddenly react. You haven't spent every drop of energy. So what you realize is that actually you're not as tired as you think you are. It's just your mind trying to tell you to stop and try and think of ways to slow you down. It's one thing to know that in the heat of the moment that you get so convinced that you can't carry on because your feet are hurting and your feet haven't hurt before. Or you can start feeling pains which feel like genuine, like injuries, and just that thought of like, who cares really? You know, it really becomes so overwhelming, and it's true really. I mean, who cares? It's not life or death. And in some ways, if it was life or death, you probably would keep going easier because then you'd have to. But because it's a race where, I was never competing to win any of these races, so there wasn't, although I have my own competitive goals and aims, it's never that serious. So I'm constantly battling with these doubts. But then what's amazing is once you go through these barriers, it's like your mind accepts it. You go, okay, all right, you're going to carry on. Okay, here's all your energy back again. And you feel great suddenly. Yeah. It's all returned to you. It's like the well is reopened and you're, I feel amazing. And then what I would always do is get carried away with that. I go, oh, this is incredible. I'm back. I'm winning. I'm gonna catch that leader. Look, I can see him 10 miles in the distance. And then I'd overcook it again and I have to go through the whole thing.
That's a double dip. Yeah. So, I mean, with that mental resilience, have you kind of taken that into your day-to-day running now? Do you use it on a park run on a Saturday or Sunday morning or when you're going out for a 10K or a
Yeah, you can do it. I mean, I actually have done very little running in the year since I finished the last ultra run.
I'm not surprised.
And I do feel like partly I needed some time and space to let my body recover. Partly I've had a few little niggling injuries and I've just given myself, I've kind of seen that as a sign. But I did get asked for a magazine article, I got asked to run a marathon, and I had done very little training, and that would have been quite a mammoth task before. And I remember there's always a point in a road marathon where you get 10 miles to go where I'm always like, oh my God, still 10 miles to go. And in all the ultras, 10 miles to go was like, oh, it was like the bell on the last lap. That was like, oh, you're in sight of the finish. So when I got to 10 miles to go after only 16 miles, I was like, what? Only 10 miles to go. We're on the home straight. This is easy. So yeah, so you get to take it into that. What's also interesting, I think you get to take it into your day-to-day life. And there's there's not that often that you're that challenged, but there are occasions. And sometimes, you know, for some reason I don't sleep very much one night. I'm not going into the next day thinking, oh my God, how am I going to cope with today? It's like, well, you know, I've run three nights consecutively. I don't, you know, one night with a little bit of a bad sleep is not a problem. Or in fact, there was one story. It was one of those nights where there was a huge snowfall and I was getting a train back from London to Devon where I live. And I got off the train and all the roads were so thick with snow, there were no taxis, there was no way home, basically. And everyone was getting off the train, kind of calling people, but they were saying, we can't come and get you. And they were like, there were cars on the side of the road, people sleeping in the cars. It was kind of this kind of Armageddon situation. I exaggerate, not Armageddon, but this, there was this feeling like, you know, panic, what are we going to do? And I just thought, you know, I live about 3 miles from the station, you know, it's snowing. All right, it's midnight, but who cares? It's, I just walk home, you know, it's not a problem.
You've done it. You've done it in the Rockies. Yeah, you can do it in Devon. You
know, it was minor problem for me, whereas for other people, I could see it was a big problem they were having to face suddenly.
Yeah. It's a fascinating insight, the book, The Rise of the Ultra Runners, into the world and the subculture of ultra marathon running. Were you daunted kind of approaching the topic, entering this world?
Yeah, I was daunted actually, particularly by the races. I kept looking initially, it wasn't so much the distances. I'd look at like 100K, I think, oh, that sounds okay. And then you watch the race video and there's people like, you know, breaking down, and you look at the elevation charts, how high you've got to go up, and like, can I really do that? And the kind of dangers of like running in the desert, you had to bring an anti-venom pump with you and a knife in case you got, you know, attacked by snakes and stuff. And those things were a bit scary. And I had this kind of slightly different issue in that I came from being quite a serious roadrunner. And I just felt like ultra running was not for, I'm in quote marks here with my fingers, not for real runners. You know, it was for people who were perhaps more into adventure and hiking. And it was just, like, I mean, when you look at the pace that like ultra runs are completed in, you know, it's 10, 12, 15 minute miles, which to me was barely faster than walking. What I didn't realize is when you're in the mountains, like, pace doesn't really align to being on a 26 mile run on the road. So I also had this slight suspicion that I wasn't going to quite fit in from that point of view. But actually, it's a fabulous world. The community in ultra running is really strong. I think there's less kind of competitiveness. There's less, you know, obviously because the course is all different, people aren't worrying about times and things. So people are really there for the adventure, even though there's some amazing runners who are getting into ultra running now, and more that's happening as the sport's growing. But it did take me a while. Yeah, I kind of always felt like an outsider. And also because I was partly doing it for the book. So I didn't feel like I had this genuine desire to do all these races. I mean, I had a desire, I had an interest, and you know, I was intrigued by them, but I felt like I was slightly being a voyeur on the whole scene. But then I got to where there's one race that I kind of nail. There's only one race in the whole book where I just feel like I've got it. And it's a brilliant feeling. And I really see the appeal. I mean, there's two appeals. So there's the appeal of struggling and really fighting hard and dealing with that situation and having those crises. But there is also a great feeling of being able to run. That race was 78 miles in the mountains and feel strong the whole way. I mean, you do across that finishing line thinking, oh my God, I'm like, I'm Superman. Look at me fly. And that was a nice feeling as well. And after that race, I definitely felt like I'd earned my stripes, so to speak. I was kind of like, whoa, I'm in here. In fact, it was after that race I started wearing a trucker cap most of the time. Probably grew a beard, got a tattoo. I can't remember.
Like Forrest Gump.
Well, there is a kind of ultra runner look. They call it the ultra runner beard, and they do all wear trucker caps, and you see a lot of tattoos. And
yeah.
It's kind of an into the wild, kind of wizened, kind of outback or wild west of America kind of look. And people even say to me, I like, oh, especially when I wear the trucker cap, oh, now you're starting to look like an ultra runner. It's like, it's just the cap. Take the cap off. But somehow, after that race, I did feel like more like an ultra runner in a weird way.
I mean, it's a wild journey that you go on throughout the course of the book. And at times we can see you struggling physically, mentally, especially on those races which go over a couple of days when you think your body's about to shut down. You have to get up the next day and do it all over again. With those experiences that you had, the lows, you also couple them with almost euphoric highs and post-race you find like and you write that other people find like bliss in the mundane of a fresh duvet or a hot shower. Would you take and I guess you've kind of already said that you're itching to go again. Would you take those lows to experience those highs again?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would hope that the lows weren't so low next time. I feel like while there is something to be gained from being there, that's not, I think it would be more subconscious that I'd be going expecting that. I think if you think about it too much, you just wouldn't do it, because it is, it's tough. I mean, it's just like every inch, every ounce of your body is screaming to stop, and you've got like unfathomable, you know, you've got 50 miles to go, or like 2 days to go, or these ridiculous distances that you can't even think about, you know, they're too big. And so I wouldn't say, oh yeah, I really want that again. But at the same time, I know that's kind of integral to the overall experience. So yeah, it's a hard one. It's a hard one to put your finger on. Why do you really need that low to experience that high? I mean, in a way you do. I think you go into it without really, you just know that there's this experience, there's this adventure, there's this journey to be had, and that stuff is going to happen along the way. And you don't think too much about what that stuff is, but you know that it's going to hurt and it's going to challenge you, and that you're going to face that and you're going to deal with that, and you're going to enjoy that. But if you start thinking, yeah, I really want to get into real pain, well, some people maybe they do, but I kind of have to block that out, because it's just, yeah, at no point in that moment did I really want to be there. There's a funny quote, I think, where someone says, when she's in that moment, Elizabeth Barnes, she says, when she's in that moment of absolute torture, she thinks, well, at least I'm not stuck behind a desk in London. And I remember thinking, God, I really, in that moment, I always think, God, I wish I was stuck behind a desk in London, because that would be so much easier and so much more comfortable. So I always have this doubt running through the whole book, am I really an ultra runner, because of these kind of stories I hear and I don't quite share. But at the same time, I am keen to do another one, but I think I would hope that it would be more like that race that I nailed, that I just feel great. But I know it probably wouldn't be, but I still would like to do it.
If you want to win signed copies of all of the books shortlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year prize and two tickets to the awards ceremony itself on December the 5th, including travel and accommodation, head over to @BookiePrize on Twitter. That's BOOKIEPRIZE. Give us a follow and like the pinned tweet.
So that was Darren Ann Finn speaking to me about his book, Rise of the Ultra Runners. Ollie, over to you now. You've been speaking to the chair of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year judging panel, Alison Rudd, about one of her favourite books.
Yeah, so earlier I spoke to Alison, who's been on the Sports Book of the Year judging panel for a number of years now. And lots of you will know Alison, sports writer, columnist for The Times. She's also recently penned her debut novel, The First Time Lauren Paling Died, to go alongside her previous works on Matthew Harding and her memoir on park football, AstroTurf Blonde. Now, her choice for our first book club, as you mentioned, is Dark Trade, Lost in Boxing by Donald McRae, which won the award in 1996. And I think Alison has previously said that reading this book made her want to become a judge of the award. And lo and behold, she's not only a judge, but she is chair of our judging panel for the first time this year. Now, Dark Trade is a pretty interesting book. Now, it's McRae's first foray into writing a book about boxing, which has been a particular fascination of his since his childhood in South Africa, where he saw the influence of inspirational fighters such as Muhammad Ali on the local population under apartheid. Now, McRae originally planned to call the book Showtime, and as he says, he wanted to string together an amusing collection of stories looking at the gaudy world of big-time boxing and its players. Now, we still get that as McRae gains an audience with the kind of P.T. Barnum-like promoters who essentially run the sport. And he also gets access to some of the biggest names in boxing at that time in the 90s. So we've got Mike Tyson, Chris Eubank, Oscar De La Hoya, and James Toney. He even actually follows James Toney on his ringside walk for one of his bouts. But as we go along, there's clearly more to the picture of boxing that Donald is creating. And he himself, as he says, gets lost in the sport. There's family feuds, there's moving acts of brotherhood between the boxers. And as the narrative develops, we do get a bit more of an idea of just the political, the moral, and the social consequence of boxing. And it's a sport that McRae has returned to ever since. Now, obviously, many of the themes that Donald addresses are still relevant and pressing to the sport as it exists today. So, yeah, it was good to catch up with Alison and get her thoughts on what was and clearly remains an influential book for her.
I was a sweet young girl. Innocent. No, I actually was a sort of at the start-ish of my sports writing career. I was lucky enough to cover Euro 96. And I had a young, tiny baby at home in London. And I was put to cover the countries based in the northwest of England. And I had a little sports car. And in order to cover them properly, I've since learned you can be more cynical, but I took everything literally. I thought I had to be at Italy press conference followed by Czech press conference, even though they were only half an hour apart and they were 100 miles apart. I zipped around being mad, and it was an immersive experience and absolutely wonderful, and cemented my passion to be a sports writer. And at about that time, I became aware of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year. I suppose this book, Dark Trade by Donald McRae. I love all sport, but boxing's near the bottom of my list of sports. I've never covered a boxing match. I don't know if I ever will. But I just thought, it's not the sport I rush to watch. How could a book about boxing reach me? And people were saying, no, you know, book that wins the William Hill, it's bigger than the sport. Really? I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a go. And I became lost in the book about boxing. It was different. It's very beautiful, reflective. And because boxing is such a wham-bam, thuggish sport, very masculine, very macho, lots of blood, lots of injury, lots of death, lots of bad things. There's so much soul-searching and poignancy and sadness in it. So it sort of slightly messed with my head and what I thought the world of boxing would be. And of course, anyone who has read it knows that Donald sort of mastered the art of making him the story and not the story at the same time. Yeah. So you learned a lot about him, about why he loved boxing.
And how does that work in the story? Because you say it's quite a personal start. We land in Soweto, you know, kind of growing, listening to Donald's memories of growing up there in an apartheid rural country. And that's kind of, as you say, woven into the book. Is that a difficult skill to do, to maintain a kind of personal and the subject matter in the same view?
It can be a difficult thing to do, and a great many writers don't pull it off. The reason it works here, I think, is that you meet Donald as a child and he instantly lets you know that he finds it difficult, the segregation, the fact that there are workers in black work gangs outside his bedroom window. And because you meet him as a child, and children tend not to have many racist bones in their body, and they grow up being one way or another, and you can tell he's going to grow up with huge respect for anyone who loves boxing, whether they're black or white or whatever. So you sort of grow with him, and it's almost like he can't help being a white South African, can he? What he's been born as, it's how he deals with it, and how it fires his passion for boxing, and it informs the way he talks to boxers from different backgrounds and ethnicities as well, I think.
Donald gets very close to the boxers. He says at one point, above all, he likes them, you know, as people. The tone of his writing is not really cynical. It's not sanctimonious about some of the tragedies that we hear about in the book. Is that kind of its strength, the book, that it's non-judgmental? It steps back from the tragedies of boxing and it can look at it from a broad lens of all the people who are in it.
I wouldn't classify it as investigative journalism. It's a journey. It's Donald McRae's journey. And he pulls it off again because he starts off in the book as a child and explains why he fell in love, became obsessed with it. It's not as if halfway through he suddenly pretends, oh, you know, I'm a hard-nosed journalist and I've got to behave in a different way. It's always him. He's true to his self and he doesn't hide the fact that he adores people. I mean, he actually will interview a boxer and say, I really like you. I've always really liked you. He's like a bit of a stalker a lot of the time. Yeah. And you can see, and he conveys quite well, you can picture the boxer sort of giving him a sort of twinkly smile and thinking, oh, it's him again. You know, he's not like he's portraying himself as a hero for doing this. It's just the perseverance of having a dream and an obsession.
Him and James Tony, I think, is seemingly his favourite in the book. He makes no bones about that. And they're just sort of two lads hanging out at times, and you're just reading about it. I mean, the bouts themselves in the book, I think they're very lyrically described. I mean, Don is clearly close to the action and enjoying himself and kind of transfixed by what's going on. Does that help the style of writing? Is the fact that, as you said before, that the sport is so immediate and in your face and dangerous that we just can't really look away?
Yeah, and also there's something compelling about knowing how vulnerable a young man is, and then suddenly you're seeing him with broken tooth and his face has gone a funny colour, and he's in a very dangerous situation, and it's that sort of, there's always a camp for one and a camp for the other, and you know the stories behind each, but someone has to be painted as the good guy and someone the bad guy, someone the fading star, someone the up and coming star, and that all around them there are people prodding and prodding, trying to make them say nasty things, and Donald does it himself. He'll go from one boxer to the other and saying, do you like him, do you really like him, because he says you're old. And, you know, it's push all the time, so that even if they felt equivocal as they went and sportsmanlike as they entered the ring, you sort of feel it's in everyone's interest that there's something else going on.
And you say you came to this as a newcomer to boxing, and do you feel this is kind of the essence of the William Hill Award in this book, in that arguably it's more enjoyable if you don't know much about boxing? There's a kind of uncertainty about where this is all going. You don't know who defeated who at any point, and does that bring something to the writing as well?
When I was asked to do this podcast and pick a book, I picked this one because it's the book that proves to me that you don't have to love the sport to love the book. And also, the book doesn't have to make you love the sport at the end of it. You just have to love the story, love the characters, love the writing, love the exploration, the tricks of the trade of writing, the tricks of the trade of boxing. And it gets you into communities you wouldn't know a lot about, countries you wouldn't know a lot about, sort of socioeconomic groups that you don't know about, and that the sort that the way, you know, he records quite faithfully. I think he must have, Donald, have had his tape recorder on all the time, but he records quite faithfully quite boring conversations some of the time, but that gives you the vernacular, and the, you feel you're there, and this is how they talk, and it makes you feel like a fly on the wall. So I often felt like I was with him. I mean, it helps that I'm a journalist, so I knew the vibe, but when he says, you know, he's using his elbows to push his way to the front of a pile of media trying to get a question in, and he literally elbows his way to the front, and he knows the minute he can talk. I mean, I can picture that because I've been in those situations, but the skill of the writing is that you feel you're with him, you're standing just on his shoulder, and you're eavesdropping on him. I think that's quite a skill as well.
So following you first coming to the book, you've since been on the panel for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year for a number of years, just been made chair for this year, and recently also released your debut novel, which has been very well received, so congratulations on that front. But I guess all forms of reading are fairly useful to a writer, but is there something about awards judging and kind of breaking a book down into its components that helps at all, or even inspires just getting access to lots of different writing that kind of helps on that front at all?
That is such a good question. Mainly because no one's ever asked. I've never heard it asked before, and I've not been asked it before. And I am a judge junkie, so I've done a lot of judging. And I didn't do it so that it would help me become a novelist. But you're absolutely spot on, because you're being so critical, and if you read a hell of a lot of books, you end up throwing them over your shoulder after 20, 30, 40, 50 pages. I mean, if they're no good, you're not going to finish them.
No.
So you become very critical. At the same time, you're searching for something that will grab you. You become sort of demonic. I want the next book I pick up to grab me. I want it to say, wow, wow, you can't put me down. You learn from that. That's just like a basic lesson. You learn from that. You've got to grab people from the first page.
And just finally, so Don McRae, author of Dark Trade, is in the running again for this year's award. His book on the Irish Troubles, so In Sunshine or In Shadow. Without giving too much away as chair of the panel, do you get the sense generally that we're in for quite a close year again this year for the award?
The privilege, because as you say, this is my first time in the chair. And the privilege of that is the judges tell me their thinking. So I know what they're favourites are, secret, and what the secrets. Ones and what the ones they have no desire to read again are. So I can tell you, I can tell you, it's going to be a very feisty discussion, and I can also tell you, there isn't a bad book on the shortlist. They're all worthy winners. So it'll be a joyous, feisty discussion.
That's certainly got us in the mood, I think, for the next few weeks. Good stuff. Alison, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
So that concludes the first ever William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast. Thank you, Ollie, for joining me. And a big thanks to Adarinand and Alison. We'll be back next time.
The William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast is a Muddy Knees Media production.